So I'm Sasha Costanza-Chalk. I'm Assistant Professor of Civic Media and MIT's Comparative Media Studies Department. And I'm also a Berkman faculty affiliate. I was a fellow with Tom. And I'm really excited that Andrew's able to join us. So we were talking just before the panel and recalling the time that we actually met, which was in 2003 in Geneva during the World Summit on the Information Society, where we were involved in a counter-summit called We Seize. And we did this great event where we actually set up a projector outside the World Intellectual Property Organization where we showed Negative Land's Gimme the Mermaid and had people chanting, wipe out, wipe-o, wipe out, wipe-o. But from days of yore as a scrappy activist, Andrew Lowenthal has now blossomed into executive director of the premier human rights and environmental video organization in the Asia-Pacific region, Engage Media, among many other talents. So we're lucky to have him here with us. He's presenting here today, and he's going to be presenting tomorrow at the Center for Civic Media as well. So with that, why don't you take it away?
Great. Thank you very much, Sasha. Great to be here and meet the Berk folk who I've only seen names via the Berkman Friends list. So good to be in town, and thanks for having me. Thanks for Sasha and Amar also for making this all happen. What I wanted to do was basically go through a kind of backgrounder to why we established ourselves, the kind of context around the various issues that we seek to address in Southeast Asia, both from a political perspective and also in terms of the kind of organizing and the video making, media and internet activism that's happening in that space. So the talk itself is looking at citizen video and the networks or political networks that really exist around that, particularly online, although a lot of our focus is also offline because there are a lot of bandwidth limitations that we're still dealing with. So there's a lot of kind of hybridization and cross-mixing experimentation that goes on in how we can use both old and new media, so to speak. So maybe just also a little bit of additional background on me. I also worked at Tactical Tech for a few years. A lot of people seem to know Tactical Tech now and actually know the tool. I worked on a series of toolkits called NGO in a Box and Message in a Box as well, which people seem to know about now but didn't really know about while I was doing them. So that's really great that they're out there more, and obviously Tactical Tech has gone on to produce a lot more of those type of materials, and definitely encourage people to check them out if they haven't checked them out before. And also had a long background with the Indie Media Network, which is also the connection to Sasha, and I think there's some other ex-Indie Media alumni illustriously present as well. We're about 12 people based out of a variety of locations, mostly Jakarta, where our main office is, but also in Sydney, where I'm based, Melbourne. We have people in Singapore and also in Manila. So we're a very distributed organization working online, as well as a collection of Greek developers as well, who handle our platform and all the other nitty-gritty aspects of the technology. So what I want to first do is actually show you a video. Just to kind of set the scene, so you're going to have a little bit of an idea of the kind of work that we're doing. But I won't play the whole video because we haven't got that much time, and I want to make sure we have some time for discussion as well. So let's roll.
Singapura. Warga Kerom ini adalah pekerja kelapa sawit. Mereka sedang menuju ke perkebunan milik perusahaan Grup Raja Wali. Sebagian dari mereka telah melepaskan tanahnya untuk perkebunan kelapa sawit.
Waktu itu tahun 82-83 itu sudah daerah dom militer. Kalau dibilang pelepasan belum jelas, karena pelepasan di jalan-jalan buat pelepasan. Istilahnya ketemu di jalan disuruh tanda tangan.
Punya itu dari mana sampai ke mana di sini?
Dari Arso 3-4 sampai Arso Timur, Raja Wali. Raja Wali ada pakai 1.500 hektar, ada pakai. Karena ujung 50.000 mati di sana.
Berarti tanah Bapak sudah habis dipakai semua oleh?
Dipakai. Perusahaan pertama, PTPN 2, nah perusahaan kedua masuk Raja Wali, dia pakai lagi. 1.500 hektar dia pakai.
Okay. So, that's in a video from a citizen journalism project that we ran in West Papua, which is the furthest easternmost province or collection of two provinces actually of Indonesia. I'm going to go a little bit more into that project later. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a taste, and also because I discovered there's actually a bit of an interesting connection with Harvard, which is actually that the Raja Wali Group are a very, very large funder of the Asia Institute here. So I thought it'd be interesting to give you a perspective of how they generate their money, which, as you've seen, isn't all happy days. So we started we wanted to think about a whole number of issues that were going on within the region, and obviously my context is from Australia, and maybe initially it's interesting to note that we had the kind of political influences that led us to starting the project were really around, I guess partly the kind of anti-corporate globalization movement in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, but also a very reactionary, conservative, xenophobic government that we had in the kind of mid-90s to mid-2000s, and a fringe kind of right-wing xenophobic party that we had that was very kind of anti-Asia, talking about floods of Asians coming to Australia, how we, you know, needed to put up all these barriers and protect ourselves, and Australia was being taken over. And I mean, I'm sure you swap Asians for Mexicans, or, you know, if you're in the European context, swap it for Africans or Gypsies or whoever. So it was very kind of xenophobic politics going on that really made positioned Australia as this kind of bastion of Europe at the bottom of Asia, essentially. And there are people who are either going to reject that idea or they were going to embrace it. And so we thought we were really interested in how do we develop really daily relationships that aren't abstract, where you don't go around going, well, this is really bad, we like other people. How do we create daily relationships that actually have the possibility to become much deeper, to have collaborations that are real in that sense. So that was kind of a political context that we're interested in, but there are a lot of others emerged as we dug deeper. So issues that tended to cross borders we were particularly interested in, because we're interested in, I guess, kind of post-national sovereignties and the way that politics was being played out through globalization, but also regional forums such as ASEAN as well, and the fact that the companies and the governments were much better at organizing internationally than the people who are working around human rights issues or environmental issues. And we thought that there was an opportunity, given the technologies that were emerging, to use those technologies, obviously the internet and video because of its emotive and connecting capabilities, as organizing tools in response. There was also a really massive explosion in the region, but particularly in Indonesia, where a lot of our work concentrates. That two things that really coincided. One was the fall of Suharto, who was in power for 32 years. Vero's from Indonesia, who's here. You can ask her any questions about that. And at the same time that Suharto fell and this democratic space opened up, you also had democratization of the means of production. Video cameras became increasingly available, and then you couldn't really do much with the internet in 1998 online. I think there was less than 1% of people in Indonesia were online at that time, so you can't really claim too much about the internet bringing down dictators in that day and age. But there was certainly some influential activity that was going on. So we're really interested in this. There's this really huge explosion of production, so much going on. I mean, there are literally dozens and dozens of groups who are producing content, but very little in terms of thinking strategically about distribution. People were very much taken by the idea of, I'll throw it on YouTube, it will go viral, and, peace and harmony will ensue across the planet, which obviously doesn't tend to happen, or happens very, very rarely. There are obviously other really big challenges around bandwidth and concentrated media ownership, internet filtering that have become more and more of an issue. And again, as I mentioned, a lack of strategy that we saw and technical knowledge. People were using the technologies that they use very strategically, but often there are a lot of technologies that hadn't really filtered down, or there were often very one-dimensional ways of thinking about technologies, such as, I will just throw my video on YouTube and then it will go viral. And rather than thinking about how it intersects with campaigns and movements and other technologies that might be available that would be better in order to reach audiences. And also just a lack of networking, again, in terms of thinking about the politics in a post-national type way. Why weren't people cooperating across boundaries and borders? And this wasn't just within Southeast Asia, but within the Australian context. Why were Australians only thinking about the US and Europe and not connecting to people who are right on their doorstep? And there are multiple reasons that weren't just that are very real. And one is language, which I'll talk about in a second. But there are others that were really just the limits of imagination. So in terms of, just to give you a kind of idea of the space in terms of connectivity, Indonesia's about 22% of people are online now, which is actually growing massively. When we started doing stuff there 5 or 6 years ago, it was 10%. Maybe Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world. There's about 240 million people there. And I guarantee you in another 4 or 5 years, 100 million of them will probably be online. So they're going to be one of the biggest online populations out there. Almost anyone who is on the internet is on Facebook. I think it's the second biggest Facebook nation after the US. So for many people, the internet means Facebook. Malaysia, around 60%. Singapore has very good connectivity. Philippines, obviously a little bit less. Thailand, and then countries like East Timor and Burma, way, way down the bottom. So you're still dealing with very, very uneven distribution of connectivity within the region, and obviously within the countries. It still tends to aggregate around urban areas, obviously, but it is growing very quickly. And, we saw, I guess, an opportunity there in terms of how can we be there on the ground before a lot of this stuff's going on, so that we're well positioned as the years go by. One project which is really interesting that's happening is one called Malaysia Kini, which is one of the top websites in Malaysia, and really centers around the opposition. There's been one party in Malaysia since independence in 1957. It's never been a change of government. It's reasonably repressive. Probably people here might have looked at internet filtering in Malaysia as well, and lots of limits to organization politically as well. They frequently get DDoS, but they've been quite amazing in terms of being a real space that has convened a lot of the opposition, to the point now that perhaps not the next election, but the following one, this ruling party may well be thrown out precisely, well, not entirely, but in many ways because the online organising that has happened around it, and because people there were very quick off the mark to get online and be advocating around that. So just to give you an idea of our approach, we really think about video and online technologies in terms of campaign and social movement tools, rather than just here's another depressing story. So we really like to try and contextualize and curate that kind of content. We kind of operate as a catalyst between producers and users, or the users or the audience of that content, trying to enable, I guess, a kind of better use of that content within social change frameworks. Often we find people, again, I'll throw it on YouTube and it will go viral type thing, trying to address that, but also trying to get people who may not have any video experience thinking about, well, how can I educate or mobilize or inform my audience more through these tools. We do a lot of face-to-face network building, which I'll talk about a little bit later. A lot of field building around what is becoming known as the Video for Change arena, which I'll also dig into further along. And we're really interested in this idea of kind of reconfiguring the other, as I was saying, talking about how can we cross borders, how do we kind of mix the kind of daily set of relationships in a very intentional way, not in a kind of here's my Facebook group and I talk with lots of people from all around the world and that's great, that is great, but how do I do it in a more intentional kind of political way where I'm really conscious about the kind of crossing of boundaries and borders and the kind of all the differences that can kind of be separations between people. And again, changing that kind of political space. We're interested in how can people operate, not just in a national framework, which is often how they're told politics needs to be played out, but actually building their own configurations through the internet, which obviously doesn't have borders. Well, it can, if you're talking about filtering. So just as a kind of example of our work, that we do. This is a picture of a guy called Kiwo, who is a West Papuan guy who was tortured by Indonesian soldiers who captured the content on their own mobile phones and then distributed among themselves, which is becoming an increasingly common way in which human rights abuses are documented internationally, actually, which is quite frightening in many respects, or sickening, really. I'm not going to play the video because it's not a very enjoyable experience over lunch or if you've just finished eating. But this was a kind of interesting experience for us in terms of getting hold of this video and getting hold of a testimony afterwards and then kind of massaging or kind of contextualizing that content and then working with Human Rights Watch to package it so that they could then go and do the advocacy around it. So we kind of sit in the middle between the people who have the video and the people who could use the video more effectively. So we don't run the campaigns and we don't speak for people in that sense. We work as an enabling organization between the people who have all the background and know all the issues and are able to speak with the right kind of authority and the people who have video content but don't necessarily know the best way to be getting it out there, especially in terms of ways to do it more securely. So the result of that was that rather than getting zero sentence, the soldiers at least got 9 months because this video was available and it was documented. It was still, you know, a very, very poor type of sentence, but at least had to be acknowledged that, you know, something had happened rather than being completely swept under the rug. But I want to actually show a counterexample which disproves my point at the same time in terms of this concept of witnessing is sufficient as a way to gain justice. So this is another incident that happened in Indonesia where a group of hardline Islamists attacked a group of fringe, they're both fringe Islamists, but a kind of sect of Islam called Ahmadiyya, which they believe isn't Islam and therefore must be eradicated. In this sense, they actually killed 3 people completely on camera. The whole thing is documented. There are police watching. You don't want to watch this video. The interesting thing, unfortunately, is that despite the fact that the whole thing was captured and available, for viewing, the people who were defending themselves, whose house this mob clearly marches down to and attacks, actually got higher sentences than the people who attacked them. So the point being that just because you capture it on film doesn't actually mean that something's going to happen. And I think that's a kind of decoupling that people didn't necessarily expect 5 years ago. And I think it's interesting in terms of thinking about Syria now as well, the kind of fatigue of citizen video of here's, you know, more terrible stuff happening. And initially it seems to mobilize people, but I think there's a new effect that's happening whereby actually it doesn't always create something. And I think that is quite interesting to look at, though not necessarily very positive to think about. I'm going to jump through to thinking about how we kind of structure our programs and what it is we do in relation to some of the contexts that I've mentioned. Some of the work we do is research around the uses of online technologies, video technologies. We did just do a study on freedom of expression online in Indonesia. We're actually just about to start a project with the Center for Civic Media around video for change impact assessment and how that's being measured or not being measured, kind of common indicators that might be able to be available to us. And also another project around citizen subtitling, network citizen subtitling in the Asia Pacific. And the one I'll maybe dig slightly deeper into is this study we did around kind of genealogy of video activism and distribution practices in Indonesia. So we do have, obviously, I'm mentioning Indonesia a lot, we have a lot of focus there, about 70 or 80% of our work happens there, but we do work throughout the region as well in Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, Singapore, etc. But this was really about when we first started really wanting to look at, well, how are people thinking about distribution? What technologies are they using? What technologies aren't they using? What bandwidth do they have? The tools that they have, how do they, you know, most effectively use? And then thinking about, well, what are the possibilities here? Where is the internet headed, etc. So, I mean, we tended to find that people were using the tools they had really, really well and actually really knew their audiences a lot. So, which didn't necessarily mean being online at all. In some cases, it might just be screening to 100 people. That was the most effective thing to do, or targeting very particular audiences. And, you know, the net wasn't necessarily important to them in terms of who they were thinking about. Again, 20% of people online, probably when we did this, 14 or 15% of people online. So people were very adaptive, which we found quite interesting. But there was a lot of technologies that people didn't know about, and or if they were new, hadn't thought about a kind of much wider set of possibilities around how they might engage with them. So the kind of end of this is a kind of series of recommendations about, well, here's what could be possible given certain conditions or training or access to technology, etc. So one of the kind of largest portions that we do is around training to address some of those skills imbalances and predominantly around the distribution side of the equation, because we do find a lot of people are teaching people how to make video, although we do that as well. But the distribution technologies, outreach, engagement, and online security are often really gaps that we see that don't seem to be terribly going away. And actually, it would be great to be seeing more organizations internationally and also in the region taking up that kind of space. The other is really around developing networks. So one of those, as you can see, Mr. Sasha, somewhere up there in the top right. This is an event. He's got his lips pursed in a strange manner. It's a good look. So this is an event we did also in Indonesia in 2008 called Transmission Asia Pacific, which was a network of that actually started 2 years previously in Rome in 2006. In a era where there was YouTube, but I cannot actually even remember us talking about YouTube at this open source video event that happened then in June 2006. And it was a kind of network of open source developers who meeting with video activists to think about how could we work together to improve the tools of distribution to do that. Since then, an enormous amount of has changed, and that network has kind of moved on into other aspects. In many ways, because a lot of the problems were solved around, you know, better video compression tools, better documentation of how to use open source tools, better distribution platforms. Obviously, many of which many of the kind of alternatives of which faded away for various reasons, and I'll talk about that when I talk about the reason why we decided to keep going on that path. Another one is the Sumble network, which we started about 2 years ago, and this is different in that it's very, very regionally focused and draws people from southern Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, East Timor, and West Papua, who all are linked by a derivative language or a root language called Bahasa Melayu. You can run an event for 4 or 5 days with a kind of range of dialects or what some people also consider different languages, and get away with it, and it works. And we're interested to do that, one, because when you run events in English, the usual suspects tend to turn up in that region. They're the ones who've had the most access to education generally, and also in terms of networks that form and the ability for people to spark collaborations in tongues that aren't their own is often very limited. So we're interested in how do we build kind of networked collaboration across national spaces. The third one is Change Network, which is also just founded this year. And that's a little bit different. This is more about a network of international practitioners who are really leaders in the field of video for change. So there's folks like Witness, from New York, Video Volunteers from India, Mosserine from Egypt, Tactical Tech folks were there, Betzalem, who are an interesting human rights video group from Israel working in Palestine, assisting people to citizen document abuses and human rights violations. Digital Democracy. So these type of organizations who are, for the most part, all working with video and all enabling organizations who are training other people to use video effectively as a social change tool. And we did the event happen because there are a lot of, because these people never get together, or very, very rarely, and there is no network on an international scale. Two, because people are often replicating the content they produce and the materials and not sharing them effectively. Three, because we wanted to build the field as a space so that people actually knew that there was this arena called Video for Change in a much more, and it had, I guess, much deeper set of ideas than people might otherwise understand. And out of this has kind of come a series of projects, one of which is the Video for Change impact research that I was talking about that the network will be doing with Civic. And another is to build out a web space, v4c.org, which will house a number of training materials and also kind of showcase the work, case studies, successes, failures, etc., and try and draw people into that space more effectively. The third is a series of smaller convenings. In terms of thinking about bandwidth, and also kind of bespoke tools, when we started was pretty much around the same time as this thing called YouTube. In early 2005, we had not heard of this thing called YouTube. So we decided we should build our own software. And we still do that, which some people find beguiling. But we do it for a number of reasons. One being because we're interested in building bespoke tools that assist advocates and can assist people in contextualizing their content. So it's not just a giant bucket that you put it into and then maybe don't have a series of practices or ideas around how do I now connect my video to something on the ground to people who might do something around it. And those kind of what can be kind of simple frameworks and methodologies are often missing, and that hence people often hope for some kind of viral effect rather than working much more concretely. Secondly, of course, there are some limits of YouTube and its privacy, security, but also in terms of how it's able to serve people in the Southeast Asia region. There is no kind of local set of servers for YouTube, but it can be reasonably fast, but not necessarily for sharing large files. The software allows, 2, 3, 4 gigabyte files to be shared as well, and we run a local server in Indonesia so that people can get access to that content more easily, and we work with a television or a network of TVs there who share their content through that space, who were then, previously uploading them to YouTube, and then you have to go and do a little hack to grab the YouTube video, et cetera, and not necessarily always in great quality. So I won't dig too much into that. I'm going to dig more into that when I do the lunch talk at Civic on Thursday, if you're interested in hearing more around the software stuff. The final aspect of the work, and I guess where all this really leads, is a kind of curation and engagement program, and maybe I'll pass one that way. Excuse the glue it suffered in the tropical heat. It will come apart, but you didn't break it. We run a web space for video sharing. It's a video sharing platform for human rights, environmental content, etc., from within the Asia Pacific region, though predominantly focusing around Southeast Asia. And this is where we curate a lot of content, where we showcase content that we assist people to produce, but is also a crowdsource space where people can come and hit publish and upload their content into a niche website that focuses particularly on issues that may be of concern to them. Part of the kind of rationale here is that we're very interested in how kind of smaller niche spaces can function to incubate content and networks and connect producers that maybe a kind of giant bucket of video isn't necessarily going to do. So again, it's about the intent and kind of mixing people across various spaces. And one additional way that we do that is through an online subtitling program using Amara or Universal Subtitles, which I totally recommend people to check out if you haven't already. We've embedded their API into our site so that all the videos are available for subtitling, and then we have a coordinator who basically goes around Southeast Asia doing workshops in Manila or Bangkok, around Indonesia, Singapore, etc., building a network so far of around 300 people who are interested in volunteer subtitling human rights and environmental content from that region, both into English, but also quite importantly between Southeast Asian languages, from Tagalog to Tetum to Malayu to Thai, etc. So what we're really interested in is how can some of these common issues be more effectively shared, issues around, say, migrant workers, issues around human rights. Some people in one country are dealing with similar issues, say, around forestry, or it could be around, internet filtering issues, and enabling people to share more effectively these ideas, and then from that more effectively collaborate between themselves. Two more quick things, and then we'll grab some questions. In terms of thinking about the kind of curation and engagement side, the Papua project that I showed you a video from, this was a training project in two cities in West Papua, and maybe to add a little bit more context. So West Papua was previously a Dutch colony, and then has essentially been transferred to be an Indonesian colony since 1969. There's been a kind of ongoing resistance movement there, sometimes violent, sometimes non-violent, that has been demanding independence. In the meantime, a huge amount of transmigration has been going on, of Indonesians being, poor Indonesians being placed into West Papua, which obviously creates a lot of tensions and a huge amount of development, as I was kind of showing you, which often doesn't benefit local people. So the additional difficulty is that international media are banned for good reason in some ways from the Indonesian perspective, is because they don't want people to see what's going on. International NGOs are also banned from operating in that space. So this was really a project to train citizen journalists, video journalists in the region, to be able to tell their own stories, know how to produce, but also more importantly know how to use online technologies, both to get the content out on the web, but also to get it being engaged with, and to do that securely, which is a very big issue there because people are frequently picked up. So the package that I sent you around is a DVD of that content, which DVDs are still very important in Southeast Asia as a distribution technology, but it's also all online and available. And then we package that with education materials, background, so that it becomes a kind of education and mobilizing tool and adds the context. So again, it's not just, here's a sad story, I'm really depressed now, gee, the world sucks. There's something a little bit more tangible that you can grip onto. Ideally, we'll see how it goes. The last thing in terms of that kind of offlining is a kind of series of TV compilations that we've been doing, sourcing content from the site and then distributing it, packaging it, editing it, adding a few graphics, and then distributing it to a network of TV stations around Indonesia. There's 100+ small, actually not even that small, local and community TV. Some of them can reach audiences or reach cities of 3 or 4 million people. So there's a huge kind of possibility there for kind of mixing and weaving TV stations together through online technologies as a way to share content and then also get it offline and obviously to people who aren't always going to have internet technologies or have the net that's good enough in order to watch videos. So just to kind of throw out a few challenges of what difficulties that we have, because it's obviously not all smooth sailing. One is how we scale FOSS tools in video and what do alternatives mean when there are such huge behemoths in the space. What is our role? How do we be most effective? So that which relates, together with the niche spaces. How do we also continue to deepen our role as the connector between both the people producing and the people using, as well as people in the media. Funding, of course, which is a oldie but a not so goodie. And then scaling our methodology. So how do we kind of, we can only do so many trainings. There are a lot of people producing content now, and there's only going to be more and more. And so how do we kind of scale up on that? And actually one additional one, which I mentioned, which I didn't include there, but is quite interesting, is actually around media management and archiving. Because people are producing so much content now because it's so, hard drive space has become so incredibly cheap and flash disks and everything else are getting, solid state drives are becoming more and more accessible. We're finding so many people have masses of content and they have no real way to store it. They might just write over it and delete it, or it sits in boxes or nobody knows where it is. And this is a kind of another challenge, I think, that not just ourselves, but this kind of video for change space generally is facing. So I'll leave it there, and I'd love to hear some questions.
Hi. What is your process for verifying videos that come into you, especially videos that you want to go on and be featured on TV and whatnot, because there have been a lot of problems with, a lot of network, like recently CNN, they aired some video from YouTube, and it turned out to be less than truthful. So what's your verification
process?
Well,
I mean, when we have that kind of content, I mean, I would say that's 5 or 10% of the content that we'd have, then we generally have very direct kind of contact with the people who may have made it or are delivering it to us. So our verification is, in some ways, a much simpler kind of just trust-based networks in that sense. We don't, we're not kind of at a scale where we have lots of that kind of content coming through that we can't kind of trace it back specifically through trusted networks that already exist. But I can imagine that it's a problem as you scale and you people start submitting more and more content in that kind of way. Go ahead.
I wonder if you could say more about the really interesting problem that you talked about regarding the reception of these videos and how just by obviously documenting, you're not you don't guarantee any kind of outcome from that. And so there's a framing that would seem to be required, and there's a morality implied in a lot of the videos that are being produced, it seems, that you're supposed to view them and recognize the injustice. Mm. But of course, you can imagine that things can be viewed in such a way, depending on, as you point out, the context, where the injustice isn't recognized, perhaps your beliefs are affirmed. Mm. So when you think about curation, do you think about moral framing as well?
So what do you mean by moral framing?
I mean, thinking about the I mean, like I said, there's a morality to I'm viewing this and I see the injustice, and this either conflicts with my sense of being in the world or it reaffirms it. Mm. And so it seems like how you aggregate or curate.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who is coming to the space itself is a frame in which, because you see it next to a lot of other videos, but I also totally take your point because, I mean, the reason that the soldiers shot that video with their mobile phone is that it's a trophy film that they then circulate around and go, hey, aren't we really tough? Check out what we did to this guy. And the same with the lynching film was that it became, a lot of people were watching that video because they thought it was really, really great. So yeah, there's a definite kind of flip side to that around. It can also backfire. I think what we do is that we add it into a context, into a space where hopefully it's evident. We don't have kind of like, this is bad kind of written, this should offend your morality, but it's next to other content. And then because we're not, I mean, we kind of are a distribution platform, but we're not a kind of destination space. We kind of sit kind of in the middle again where, you know, we will feed it out to, say, Human Rights Watch, and then they will be doing the kind of larger media around it and then adding their kind of context and frame to it. So we won't necessarily talk about it because we're not necessarily the most qualified people to do it. We're the people who know about the technology and have the networks to kind of draw on. But I think it's definitely a danger. And I think that that's a lot of what the work is about, is how do you kind of build frames into that and then manage the how you might also be empowering the oppressors, I like a better word.
But part of the layer that you're also doing is that, you know, so if you think of a space like YouTube, right? So people put the stuff up and then decontextualized, whatever, it's a video on the web, and then you approach it and you engage with it however you're going to engage with it. Part of what Engage Media is doing is they're not trying to become a place where 100 million people are going to watch the video. They're working directly with the producers so that they can figure out how are they going to use the video in a campaign context, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this whole other piece of it which isn't just the web-based piece, which is what's interesting about the model. Mm. Or one of the interesting things about it.
That cover?
It does.
Cool.
And does that hold for the stuff you're doing to share out to television stations? Because that feels like a very different thing from sharing something with...
Yeah, I mean, I kind of show you the extreme examples, but most of our content isn't that, those extreme kind of examples of violence. A lot of it, you know, someone might make a video about a kind of progressive independent music scene in Indonesia, or, you know, a video about a kind of forestry issue, but won't necessarily be, you know, really massively hard hitting in that sense. It might be a kind of community video about what's going on. So, I mean, the stuff that goes onto TV definitely has that context. And then the network that we work with is a group of TVs who, I guess, have a kind of political underpinning to them because they're interested. It's kind of started by an environmental network actually in Indonesia, so they're interested in you know using TV as an outreach tool to connect with those people. Yeah.
A couple questions, somewhat related. If you could just touch on how you're funded and what you're looking for future funding. I hope your computer's okay.
I know. You said funding.
And then...
my water out. Funding? Where?
I'm there too, and I know how miserable
it is. You need funds for a new computer.
Yeah. And then that related to that, you mentioned scaling the methodology. Sort of how you're thinking about that, what your approach is, and what sort of scale you're looking at.
Sure. So funding is through Ford, OSF, the artist formerly known as OSI, Hivos, Internews, folks like Secret Grassing, it's all on our website.
Do you have a grant writing team, or how's this working for you?
It's not just me. But mostly me with a couple other people internally. But it is often grant report, grant proposal, grant report, grant. A lot of life unfolds in that way. If any great grant proposal writers, I'd be happy to talk to them. Could probably be doing some other things with my time as well. And then in terms of the scaling, so one of the things we're looking at, or that we are actually about to start, is this v4c.org space, which is connected to the Video for Change network, and that will be a database or a kind of umbrella space to collect and link to training materials that already exist. So not just ours, but other people. So we have some money to develop additional materials. A lot of it also comes from folks who know the Message in a Box site. So we're kind of taking the still relevant stuff of the video aspect of that, and the tools and the documents that exist around that, and then putting that into that new space as well. So I think one is through training materials and engaging ones, also hopefully not just text-based training materials. And then the other is really about training the trainers. So we tend to work with, because for we only really make sense for people for the most part when they already know about how to produce video and have a certain level of expertise. So we kind of come in the Papua project is different, but for the most part we come in when people already have that skill level, and then we will train them. And then success for us is absolutely when they take that training that we've done and then they will fan it out to their own networks, especially when they're doing a transition from English to another language, or they might take a document and say, hey, we're going to translate this, etc., etc. So the methodology is really about online resources and then training the trainers for the scaling. Yes.
Do you have any statistics on the return on your investment? So do you have any data on or any what was the result of your work? And have any morals reform has invigorated?
Yeah,
just to put Bentham's speech from Panopticon.
I think that there's kind of two approaches going on. So one is that very spectacular type approach, which is this video was released and this thing happened. Whereas I would actually say that 95% of video doesn't work like that and actually doesn't have those objectives. And most of the time, video is very kind of culturally cumulative. In that sense, is that in that it's building networks, it's enabling processes, it's sparking collaborations, and then things happen in a much slower train. But I think we've gotten used to a very kind of Rodney King style idea about what video can do. And I think that's actually mistakenly sold to people about you will make a video, people will watch it, and the world will change, which I don't think, I think it happened on occasion, but I don't think it always happened. So I showed you an example of where that has happened for us with that the video about Kiwo. But for the most part, I would actually say that it's most of the process is actually much softer in that sense. And so you'd be much more looking at who was trained, how many people were trained, what did they do once they were trained, what new collaborations were started, what products did they produce as a result of that, what campaigns or social movements were strengthened, because it's all kind of adds an additional piece rather than like being this, this kind of one spectacular film. So I have, two or three examples of that where it does kind of have that spectacular effect. But I would actually say vast, vast majority of the time, that's actually not really a methodology that I think is generally successful, but it's one that gets held up because it's the most spectacular.
Do you think that it's necessary to somehow be able to measure the long-term effects somehow?
Totally.
And not just in the number of people trained, but really justice being served or society being stronger.
No,
or,
absolutely.
Or the public being more aware.
No, absolutely. And this is this new Video for Change impact research that we just kind of sat down and started working on yesterday with the Center for Civic Media team is precisely going to be looking at those kind of questions, is how are people measuring impact? What different types of impact are there? Because there is the spectacular video that gets lots of mainstream attention, the Kony video, etc. And then there's the participatory video that process that someone spent, half a year in a village teaching people how to make video content that might have had a dramatic cultural transformation on that space that only 50 or 100 people saw. But then there's everything in between of that. And so we're really interested in mapping and understanding those processes, and then assisting other people who are thinking precisely about those questions. You know, where do I fit in this, and what models can I adapt to my own context? So, absolutely.
So the first stage of that work is going to actually be talking to everybody in the existing Video for Change network, which is all the organizations that Andrew mentioned before, Witness, etc., talking to people about how do they do impact assessment. So basically comparing and sharing models, whether it's looking at the impact on the person who participates in the training process or all the way to the impact on audiences who view the thing. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be sort of working to initially sort of gather and then share back out in that network existing models before we... The goal is to just sort of immediately step forward and say, here's the model of video impact assessment. Mm-hmm. Let's look at what the field is doing and then talk about the next stage.
Anyone else? Sure.
Thanks so much for your presentation and really great work. I'm very intrigued by what you said early on about reconfiguring the other mm-hmm. as one of the kinds of engagements of your work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in how that functions around cultural difference and...
Sorry, can you speak a little bit louder?
I'm interested in how that functions around cultural difference mm-hmm. and national identity and gender.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also interested in how it's because of the positioning of your work kind of across closed circuit and online distribution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of reminded of the very long histories of video activism and the way that mainstream media has been a kind of other
mm-hmm.
of video activism.
Mm-hmm.
And so how is it that your work, kind of bridging these different spaces, reconfigures that other?
Question. So I guess we kind of start with the idea of, how the technologies could be used, but well, previous to that, really, the kind of politics around that and what we were interested to address. I would say for the most part, the other that we looked at was, I guess, kind of national and kind of racial rather than gender-based. But obviously you can cross it over. But because we're interested in kind of geographical space and the distribution of people within geographical spaces that were imagined... as, you know, nationalities and how people then thought of, you know, people across the water and across the way as being different and the relations that developed out of that, which are often very negative. So, you know, why in, you know, northern Sumatra, which is, you know, 10, 20, 30 kilometers across the water from Malaysia, is there, you know, where previously there was not a border until, you know, the English and the Dutch came along and decided, you know, there is now a border here. But why do Indonesians there feel less connected to the people who are 20 or 30 kilometers away, but feel more connected to the people who are, you know, 4,000 kilometers away, right on the other side in Papua? And obviously the Papuans by that stage don't feel particularly connected. So in some ways, we were really interested in, like, how can the internet kind of reconfigure that space so that people don't think about, well, I mean, obviously, there are contexts that are national and there is, you know, sovereignties and there are laws that are enacted and there are boundaries that nations create, but we can cross them much, much more easily than we used to be able to. And then what does that mean in terms of political organizing and the space, and how can we potentially gain an advantage by changing that space so that it's kind of unexpected that people are going to be organizing in that way? And I think for some... To a degree, there are political organizations like ASEAN that do that in a kind of, you know, community of nations type way. But I think through online technologies, we can do that in a much kind of more dispersed, diasporic, you know, clustered constellations, etc. type way. So that kind of the Sumble network for us was a lot of that because we really found, and I mean, that it was strange. I mean, I'm speaking as the Australian on the team, but we're actually... So we're actually about 70% of the team is actually Southeast Asian. So we really found that Malaysians and the Indonesians have this kind of, even the most progressive activists have this kind of strange antagonism of like, we don't like the Malaysians or we don't like the Indonesians. But it wasn't a kind of rational, there's no kind of rational reason why. It was just that you kind of been brought up with this idea that, you know, we don't like them, even though we speak more or less the same language. So in some ways it seemed like the first step was to get the more progressive activists to be talking to each other and working with each other. And it's not to say that no one was doing this before we arrived, because obviously they were, and it's been going on forever. In the Melayu as a root language exists precisely as a trading language that was used around the archipelago since, you know, who knows when, as a way to for people to communicate. So we're interested in, well, how does that trading language then form into new types of networks and then dissolve differences that people perceive and, you know, begin new networks and new ways of working together. Can I answer your question in a roundabout way? You had a second one, though, as well.
Reconfiguring the other of mainstream media.
All right, yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to.
I think that's a more, in some ways, feels more difficult. Mm. Because I think the kind of economy of attention is still very much there, and I think people felt that was really going to dissolve. And maybe it did briefly before business really cottoned on to, you know, the potential of the internet as a money-making tool through crowdsourced contributions. It felt like, I mean, when I was kind of involved in things like indie media, it really felt like, you know, no one had really tapped this or seen this as a potential, you know, all the kind of potential revenue. And then I think people have a much larger overestimation of what citizen media could actually do, because they assumed that companies and money were going to stay out of it forever. So we thought, okay, well, we're just like marching towards, you know, the revolution of citizen media, and we'll all be a producer. And well, we are all producers, but we're all producers for somebody's platform, rather than, you know, something a little bit more kind of public square esque. So I think that economy of attention is, and the capital that is required, in or how useful money is now to get people's attention, was definitely underestimated. And I think it's going to be, I don't really know how that's going to play out in terms of the tactics and strategies for the future. I mean, for us, you know, for us, it's about connecting to, say, more to TV, but these TVs are still what you would probably put in the alternative. But I think this is a kind of larger challenge, and I'd love to hear other people's kind of thoughts about that kind of scaling and whether or not it's as possible as it was previously thought.
I'm just curious, do you have any plans to branch out to younger audiences and filmmakers, maybe link up to K-pop groups, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think because of where we... I think because of our approach, again, we're more useful with slightly more established filmmakers, so we would hope that the kind of methodologies around distribution and engagement were picked up by organizations that are working more with youth. And we do work with one group called Kampung Halaman a lot, who are based in Java in Indonesia, who do a lot of youth work, but I guess we don't see ourselves specifically as a youth-based organization. Although that said, you just reminded me that we are doing a youth-based project actually around anti-corruption that we'll be starting next year. So actually that is our first foray into it. So we will be doing a little bit of that in Indonesia, teaching a bit of video production and then the distribution. So thanks for reminding me.
Just one quick question. You mentioned about the second challenge that you have about developing this connection between the producer and the campaigners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what is going to be the next step, or what is your strategy?
Our strategy was to become much more specific and really develop case studies where it had been much more successful in working. So the kind of Papuan project that I sent you around was that. We used to do, I guess, very generic workshops where we would invite 10, 15 independent video makers to sit down for a weekend and then teach them, you know, open source compression tools, how to FTP, security systems, different websites they could be publishing their content to, etc. But we found like we didn't get much stickiness with it, and people, maybe one or two people would stay in our network and the rest would would disperse. So we shifted across to really focusing on very specific issues and engaging people around very specific campaigns that they were working on. So I think so the kind of future is much more about providing very good examples that other people might replicate rather than trying to expand the kind of training more generally. I think we have a couple more minutes.
Yeah,
is that right?
A couple more minutes for questions.
If anyone's got any burning questions.
Another question. Could you say more about the metrics for the evaluation that you're doing, the impact assessment that you're doing, and specifically how you're, I know you just said that you're going to interview the network of of groups first. Beyond that, have you
thought? Well, it's actually a complete work in progress. We literally sat down for an hour and a half yesterday. I mean, we've got the first kind of set of the seed funding to do it, and we literally sat down yesterday, and then five or six of us reviewed the scope, and then now we need to kind of start building the scope. So I can't tell you what that is going to be yet, but if you stay connected to Sasha or grab my email or contact me, then we can definitely be updating you. And one of the ideas with the research is that we want to be blogging it regularly, so we don't kind of wait till the end for people to see any of the results, and we can start getting people's feedback on initial drafts and ideas by a blog space, which you can all be advised of, probably be through the b4c.org space. But if people want to stay in contact with any of the work we're doing, including that, then yeah, please come and give me your email or your card afterwards, and we'll make sure you keep connected.
I'm surprised no one has asked anything about Plumi, the platform. Maybe because you went quickly through it specifically for tomorrow.
But I said Thursday. But yeah, I can take questions on that.
So you sort of hinted that there was a whole debate that happened among video activist networks around between 2003 and 2006, I think, maybe 2004, 2006, where people were saying, well, do we need to build autonomous platforms, or should we be figuring out how to leverage these commercial spaces? A lot of people, of course, ended up saying, well, we have to do both, which is always the best answer. But you, Engage Media, ended up investing a lot of time and energy in building the Plumi platform. So I wonder if you could share a little bit more about the decision to do that, the things that have been good about that decision, and the things that are challenging might be useful, as some of the folks around the table have also been involved in platform building projects.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we started, there wasn't really an option. Because it was literally March 2005, and I think maybe YouTube started February 2005, but I can't remember when the date of the kind of coming out was, but I think it was at least a year or so on. So we assumed that, we would grab a CMS, we would kind of install it on our server, and then we would run this video space, which is not what happened at all. We spent a lot of time building our own platform, and then, a year or two in, kind of, the larger spaces started emerging, and then we had to kind of really reconfigure how we were thinking about the organization and its overall mission, and that kind of element did become deprioritized to a degree, and also because funders were obviously not as interested, because they were going, well, hey, there's this thing over here, and why would we fund you to build an independent platform? So there are limitations around that. We thought the context was really important, and the possibilities for that. Secondly, security issues. Thirdly, the kind of, I guess, as a kind of case study of it is possible to have alternative spaces and we don't all have to jump on board. And I think for a while that wasn't very popular. And I think over the last two or three years, it feels like, the hype around social media and crowdsourced media sharing platforms has died down, and there's much more of a critique around, privacy issues, the security issues, the data mining, etc. And so now I feel like we're a little bit more well-positioned than we were a few years ago, because people have kind of gotten that there's more issues with these large platforms than, now that the shine's rubbed off a little bit. And I think it is getting easier in terms of storage and bandwidth and the technology and the kind of cumulative effects of that. But I'd also say that it has very much slowed us down, because we can't have all the bells and whistles that you know, a site with millions of dollars worth of development can achieve. So then we have to really think about the kind of focus and having enough bells and whistles, but not obsessing about, well, it doesn't do this and it doesn't do that and it doesn't do all these other things, and just being like making it kind of clear. And, you know, the main thing is always still going to be the video, I think, because I think the other stuff wears off eventually. The video and connecting it to something real, and the networks that really underpin that. So I think for us, a lot of the strength comes from the fact that we have very real networks that are built face to face that then connect through this online space, which wasn't how we imagined it initially. We had a, if we build it, they will come. Whereas really we built it and then we spent a lot of time doing a lot of on the ground work to get people to turn up. So I think what we have now is much more of a kind of incubator space, rather than a media outlet, say, that we initially thought we'd have.
Mako, aren't you writing a paper called 8 Almost YouTubes?
No. Yeah.
I think that sounds creepy. So I've looked at a lot of people creating a bunch of previous attempts to create online encyclopedia projects created for Wikipedia. My intuition is that and sort of I think supported by some of that research, is that the technical platforms don't matter as much as people think they do. So I guess that supports your intuition and your response to that question. I mean, you think of like just an enormous amount of sort of like, if you look at like static images, right? And like people that are distributing that, like in a, like Wikimedia Commons, very, very good. Wikimedia Commons, bad along almost any dimension in terms of like having the kinds of features that you'd expect in something like Flickr or something like that, right? I mean, it's like it's really designed for text, and people have hacked it into working for images, and it works well enough to support the networks and the collaboration and the production, so and the distribution. Yep. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. And one anomaly or which fits into that theory, and I don't know if they still use it, but Athens Indie Media still runs the Active Code, which was the very first Indie Media code from 1998, was the first kind of release of it. And they're running that code 14, you know, probably with a few hacks, but not very much, 14 years later. At least they were a year ago, 13 years later. And they are one of the most active citizen media spaces in Greece. And it's nothing to do with the technology, because the technology is incredibly rudimentary. But you can do the basics, which are, I can post an article, I can stick a picture up, I can add a link, and I can comment. But most importantly, all my friends or the people I want to talk to or I really don't like are also here, so I can make comments about how crap they are. I think it becomes about the community. There's probably lots of those where the technology is not great, but the community really supports it and has invested and has ownership in it.
I think we have time for maybe just another question, last question or two. Maya, do you?
I have a bit of a chaotic question. Because I am building upon Shasha's comment, I am thinking about how the late wave of mobilization, particularly in Spain with the Indignados, you know, have a bit shift the discussion about autonomous media or not. And I think in the case of Spain, there is very interesting to extract how the ability to create ecosystem between alternative media corporate new media, in the sense of connecting the conversation in Twitter in order to arrive to a larger audiences. With also what have been happening in Spain is that not only like Twitter and Facebook has been increasingly growth for the mobilization process, but also there has been an increase of alternative media, concretely a platform called N-1. N-1.
Uh-huh.
That is some kind of space for working groups that is hidden. I mean, if you don't have the permission, you cannot get in. And so it's filtered through networks of trust in activist communities. But what I find is that in this kind of combination of corporate media and all online, but corporate media and alternative media, is that corporate media allowed to arrive to the whole audience. Because in Twitter and Facebook, there is everybody, not only activist circles. And the alternative one, it's like activist circles. And the element of the activist circles, like, for example, filtering through trust, is a key element for making it function. Or the access to physical spaces when there is a face-to-face community. And I don't know if, like, that equilibrium works well in the sense of there is a distribution of functions in, depending on the... But my point is that why somehow, like, alternative media, it has some kind of a non-possibility to go into the general audience? Why it have to be only for activist audience in order to work?
But I don't think it has to be only for activist audiences in order to work. And when it's good, it's and when it's good, it's not just for activist audiences. But I think there's different spaces. So the N-1 sounds like it's a great incubator and organizing space that maybe is required for security and mobilization that where you it isn't necessary to share with other people. But there are other platforms where, and I think the best ones do this, and they have a crossover audience, and they're growing in that sense, but and also that they are able to reach and cross bridges into the corporate platforms. And I think you can't necessarily stay isolated and kind of have your kind of hippie commune of you know, utopia on your web space, because I think it's good for you know, creating an initial community, but it's not necessarily going to be it's not the end. It's part of the means to kind of gaining that audience, finding those people. But I think that those incubator spaces are really, really important in order to do that. But yeah, there's definitely a problem with ghettoization. And I mean, I think that's been a problem within social movements since forever, where, you know, there's a tension between the ghetto and the kind of purity of the politics and the platform, and we don't go near that corporate stuff, and then having reach and effectiveness. And I think what should be possible with online spaces, and has proven itself possible in many occasions, is that you can be small and also have a massive audience. That's the big sell, right? That you can do that, and so you don't have to rely. But I think that that promise is much less than it used to be.
I actually think, Mayo, that one of the we've been limiting. People who are focused on activism and political movements and the creation of autonomous spaces have limited the conversation by focusing only on the debate between, you know, do we need to be in the commercial social media spaces or build our autonomous spaces as activists? Because if you look more broadly, I think the answer to your question is that all kinds of communities of high interest in a particular space do build autonomous spaces. I'm thinking of fandoms, right? So, like, you can go to the bronies, right? So, like, young male fans of My Little Pony Friendship is Magic have built their own version of 4chan, right? And you see this happen, it happens time and time again. So basically fandoms are people who, they're not necessarily identifying as activists, but they're creating autonomous spaces which are for an in-group community. Often they're using free software tools just because they can grab them and use them and set up a space, but not necessarily, and they're not necessarily ideologically committed to free software. But I do think you see sort of the proliferation of sort of in-group community spaces where people can talk really intensely about something they really care a lot about, but they also then take some of the best of that work and push it back out, you know, into the mass media platforms. So I think it does happen, and sometimes we sort of have kept blinders on a little bit too much in limiting the debate to, like, between autonomous activist spaces and commercial social media platforms.
Make sure.
You know, I'll say that to respond to that is that I think that actually large firms are also also very interested in and actively involved in this space. If you're looking for free alternatives to Twitter, you can look at projects like StatusNet, which is funded entirely by large firms who would love to use Twitter but are not willing to put their firm's sort of like communications to rely on, you know, another company for their firm's communication infrastructure. So they will be willing to participate in a free software project, which is creating infrastructure which can be used by anybody, and which federates, so because they're not interested in creating an island completely separated from everything else, but they are interested in creating an island which exists on servers that they own and they control, and are willing in pursuing infrastructure which will be more broadly shared. And in this space, sort of, like I think a lot of the interesting stuff in this space is actually being driven by large firms who want autonomy and control over their technological infrastructure. And I think that projects like what you're working on is I think you're seeing a lot of stuff in that space, and there's avenues for taking advantage of the work that the firm's done in ways which the free software community has done very effectively, and which activists using free software have been able to do very effectively.
And also, just to clarify, the platform we build is open source and is based on top of Plone. So we leverage Plone as, you know, basically 95% of the engine to do what we do.
I think there is an underlying message on what you both, Meko and Sasha, and your and what you have been saying, is that in order to have a truly collaboration or community kind of engagement, you need autonomy and you need control. It be a corporation that wants to have control and autonomy over its communication and its collaboration, or be activists. And this is something like, I think there is a very meaningful thing on this. Like, if we think about corporate media that allows certain type of collective action, but there are other certain times that involve much more cooperation, much more doing things together, that is not the frame that would allow. And I am saying this because I actually also did a statistical analysis of 50 cases about how the typology of more or less autonomy and control over the infrastructure actually explain what the communities are doing. So the communities which are the more collaborative ones are the ones which have more autonomy in their infrastructure. So in the debate about corporate media, yes or not, needs to be also considered that it's not corporate media is can work on everything. No, if you want really cooperation, corporate media is not an option. Like, in the sense, it doesn't work. Very collaborative, very cooperative kind of civil collective action require autonomy. And in a very diverse plurality of scenarios, from corporate to activists.
Although, just to make that a little more messy, you mentioned the Mosserine Collective, and I think they're a great example of this kind of bridging of spaces, and they work in Cairo, and they go around the city and project on the side of buildings videos that folks either closely affiliated with the collective or who submit to the collective produce. And they also have a YouTube channel that has 4 million video views, and which allows for screening quality downloads.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Mosserine are being really successful. They also just raised $40,000, effectively. And actually, when I went to the Pirate Bay, they had like a giant, the front page of the Pirate Bay was support Mosserine, which is really interesting. So that, I think they've leveraged a lot of, mainstream tools. So I don't think that, I mean, I think the reason people go to them is because they work in many respects. So I don't think you can deny that people aren't able to use these tools effectively, but there obviously then are limitations as to what you're able to do with them, and there is a kind of path that we are being shepherded down, which I think is also potentially dangerous in terms of, you know, ownership, control, freedom, etc. But I mean, we operating in the Indonesian space, as you saw, like almost everyone's on Facebook, so we can't not be on Facebook. We have to be on Facebook, or nobody even knows we exist. And most of our inlinks come from Facebook. That's how people, we post something out onto our Facebook group, and that's how people come to the site. They don't just, you know, we're not a space, we're not a destination where people just arrive. Facebook's the destination, and then we have to be sending stuff out, and then people will come. So we have to play with them, but we don't necessarily want to live with them.
So building face-to-face connections and existing both in autonomous spaces as well as corporate spaces. So thanks, Andrew, and we should probably close that.